This is KAZU, Pacific Grove, California. Radio with a Choice. This is Mae Brussel. The name of my program is World Watchers, and it is program number 813, July the 6th, 1987. Before we begin the program, I want to say that the views expressed on this show are those of myself and do not necessarily reflect the views of KAZU's staff or their board of directors. We also want to thank Coast Components at 684-1185, the Monterey Bay Area's distributor of electronic components. Thank you for the underwriting grant that helps bring you this next hour of World Watchers. The Wall Street Journal had a story about Oliver North today, who will be testifying tomorrow, on page 26, titled "Iran-Contra Panel to Begin Questioning North," focusing on the White House attempts to mislead. And they listed six crucial dates from November 20th to 25th. And then there was a subtitle that said November 22nd, smoking gun. And that is the day, of course, that they discovered the memo that had to do with diverting the funds from the Iranian gun sales and weapon sales, the various weapons, to the Contras. It was called November 22nd, the smoking gun. And as I've said so many times on this program, what goes around comes around. And the smoking gun was in Dallas November 22nd, 24 years ago. It's interesting that Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan are going to fall down in history on the same with the same date and the memo located about Oliver North's activities with the National Security Council and the agencies of the federal government, and the anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. The Monterey Herald had an article June 27, 1968, that I've had on the air quite a few times, titled "Reagan Aid Studies Extradition Plea." And this had to do with Governor Reagan's top legal advisor, Edwin Meese III, studying whether or not to extradite a man to New Orleans who Jim Garrison accused of having a role in killing John Kennedy. And Edwin Meese III was Reagan's legal advisor in Sacramento, in California in those days. And he protected Edgar Eugene Bradley. Bradley was the West Coast representative for Dr. Carl McIntyre, a radio evangelist charged by Jim Garrison, New Orleans, with conspiracy to assassinate the president on November 22, 1963. Carl McIntyre was a very close friend of J. Edgar Hoover. He worked with Domestic Division 5 of the FBI. He worked with Albert Osborne and Oswald's doubles that went into Mexico and played a very major part in the assassination. And Bradley's attorney, George Jensen, argued, or didn't argue hard, to Ronald Reagan that the Warren Commission said Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in the assassination, and that if Reagan and Meese extradited Bradley to Louisiana, the state would be denying the validity of the Warren Commission. And Ronald Reagan didn't want to do that. And neither did Edwin Meese, so they protected the assassins of John Kennedy from ever coming to court or justice or to effect the change of history. But history caught up with Ronald Reagan, and on November 22nd, 1986, it rolled around on the same day, and it brought Ronald Reagan and Edwin Meese to the point where they are today. Now, several times on this broadcast, I have mentioned a visit I had with a Dr. Walsh in Beverly Hills on Bedford Drive, who was 30 years with the Mayo Clinic, who had seen over 50 heads of state, including Charles de Gaulle and Torrijos, and very many of them. He was the only American psychologist to see Rudolf Hess at Spandau Prison. And when Reagan became president, he had an interview in the LA Times that I've cited before, and it's more pertinent now than ever. That Reagan was a dangerous person. He wasn't mentally fit to be president. He had deficiencies of the brain. He wanted to bring bayonets to the UCLA campus. And now it seems more important than ever to bring in those white coats and examine Ronald Reagan to see his mental state as he brings us to the brink of World War III. When Reagan became president, he said at a time of debate with Jimmy Carter, when the question came up of possible senility, he offered that he would submit to mental tests if he got senile or out of touch, but the person who is out of touch doesn't know it, and it's up to the American people to recognize a very sick person when they have one. The president has had two cancer operations. He grows tumors every year. We're told they're benign, but he has the capacity to keep growing them continuously. He has medications, and those can affect his mind and his rationale. If he is potentially a dying person, he'll do things differently than if he thinks he has longevity to enjoy and sit back for the things that he would have accomplished. He can't be interviewed off the cuff. Everything he says is rehearsed. And while we know his speeches were on 3x5 cards before, I understand that at the summit in Venice, I read that even in a private meeting with Margaret Thatcher, he read cards that he could not even remember what to say among the proximity of his closest friends. He allowed 9 days for the summit, so what he had, what he called jet lag, wouldn't be effective going there and coming back. And yet it was revealed that Howard Baker, the chief of staff, kept poking him or giving him cold water and waking him up. He slept through the Venice summit. He diverted the topic last year because he couldn't have conversation last year, and had just bombed Libya and diverted the economic summit in Japan to the subject of Libyan violence and the Berlin disco, which Gaddafi didn't bomb. And this year, he all of a sudden came up with the Persian Gulf event with Iraq shooting part of our ship, the Stark, USS Stark. Then he went to the summit with another agent provocateur subject that the Allies didn't relate to. It was an economic summit, and he diverted again from the business of state. This year, when the Iraq missile, the airplane, hit the USS Stark, he appeared within hours and blamed Iran for the attack, totally out of contact with reality, and he offered immediately to put American flags on Kuwait ships and make a decision to side with Iraq in a war where he's been defending himself in the Iranian initiative because he wanted to be friends with Iran. He shows no anger at anybody for the Iran-Contra affair. He doesn't act as if he was deceived, and yet he said, "There ain't no smoking gun. I didn't know anything." He is absolutely emotionless and has a grin similar to other patsies in events who've been doctored up and played a role, such as Sirhan Sirhan or Mr. Artie Bremer or Son of Sam, a lot of these people that are brought in. He's not a, well, he is a mass killer in a sense with what he does, but he has this grin that nothing is happening and nothing's bothering him, and he says, "I'm not involved, but my people who got me into this are our heroes, they're my best friends," and that isn't the normal reaction of people who have purposely deceived you. He said everything was legal, yet he was using surreptitious means so that he wouldn't be detected breaking the Bolin Amendment. He's not worried about national security, which is what the president should be worried about. He went to the National Security Agency and commended them for not having leaks. And simultaneously, we learned that Ollie North was taking secret devices from the NSA and giving secret papers that were not to leave this country to Ayatollah Khomeini, and Reagan wasn't even disturbed about the breach in national security. He allowed Mr. Thomas Green, the attorney, to go to the Justice Department and tell them to stay away from the Miami investigation. At the time, he said he was representing General Secord and Albert Hakim and Oliver North, all three, one private individual, one retired general, and one on the staff of the National Security Agency. And by stopping the investigation in Miami, he put a lid on the drug dealing, gun running, and the heavily financed narcotics into this country, while his wife Nancy has a campaign about drugs, Just Say No. He's tangled with the major drug dealers and has halted their investigations. So the man is very sick about this policy, and it will haunt him. It will continue being exposed. He's prided himself in the fact that the best way to govern is to relegate to private individuals the decision-making, because they're knowledgeable on these facts. He's laid back, hands off, and he had a cover article in Fortune magazine about how this process works. Yet when he decided to put American flags on the Kuwait ships, his many people from the Navy, from the Army, except for Caspar Weinberger, of course, from the CIA, from the GOP, his own party, were against flagging the Kuwait ships. So at this point, he doesn't use what he calls the best minds. He says, "I'm putting them on anyway. I'm going to make the decision," after he says, "I've relegated these decisions to other people." As far as Iran goes, the President of the United States has changed his story so many times that it is perfectly obvious the man is sick. He said he wanted close ties with them because it's geopolitical, the strategy of Iran being so close to Russia. We need them as an ally. And then we find out now that he's ready to send a provocative bomb or missile or two over to Iran to wipe out the weapons they bought from China and possibly start World War III. He said he was working with moderates for when Khomeini gets out, and he was working with members of the Savak, the Shah's deadly team, similar to the Gestapo in Germany. And he's working with, and his people met with, those very persons who held the Americans hostage for over a year, 52 Americans. On one hand, he wants to open a dialogue, and then we find out that there's documents and material that that Ali North and the team were actually planning to kill Khomeini and kill top Iranians, and they were sending weapons there for that purpose. All of this keeping peace in the Middle East, not siding with Iran or Iraq, sending our ships there on a moment's notice, is a sign that the head of state is not the head of state. And as I say, it's time to bring in the white coats. When Iraq attacked our ship, he immediately blamed Iran. He immediately said, we will go on the side of Kuwait and protect them while they give Iraq, the country that bombed us, their oil. And Albert Hakim said he had presidential approval, national security approval, to go to Kuwait and get their 17 prisoners released. The 17 people killed one American and bombed the American embassy. So he's rewarding them against Iran, the country he said he wanted to get along with. Now, this is a cornered animal. He's old and he's cornered and he's sick. All of his agencies are on the defensive, the CIA, the Defense Department, the National Security Council, the National Security Agency. He's so much on the defensive, he brought in Frank Carlucci as the National Security Advisor, a partner with Eric von Marburg, a key player in all of this, von Marburg, a part of Stanford Technology Training Group, with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel and Thomas Kleins and Theodore Shackley. So the person guarding the president for the National Security Council is himself involved in business deals through the year and with sending weapons from the Defense Department to arm Gaddafi, the great terrorist that Reagan consumed so much time about last year. He's cornered by the fact that not his associates, not members of the GOP, there's 97 of them under investigation, but his closest family are under legal investigation at the present time. Michael Deaver, Edwin Meese, and Lynn Nofziger. These people going back to his early days in California. His close associate, William Clark, has taken a powder. He hasn't been visible, seen, or heard from. His family's not around, and his best friends have special prosecutors. They can't trust the attorney general, and the attorney general's under investigation himself for all of these matters. So when a person sees his close associates possibly going to jail, losing their savings or their homes, and then his working associates from the National Security Council, Robert McFarlane, Admiral Poindexter, and Oliver North, committing literally treason against this country and planning the overthrow of this country, the elimination of the Constitution that I'll get to in a minute, this is an animal that will do anything. And our biggest problem now is to make sure that those flags, we can't do it, but people in Washington should watch the flags on the Kuwait ships. Right now, the chief of staff is somewhat backing down. We'll get out of the Gulf if Russia gets out of the Gulf. And the Soviet Union knows, I'm sure, that they're dealing with a crazy man. He also knows that his vice president, the former CIA director, hasn't been involved in any of this material. I mentioned last week he's immune from inquiry. Nobody points fingers at him. He worked as the director of the CIA. So as Reagan's people all get cornered, George Bush attended all the NSC meetings. In some way, it must be scary to have your vice president so immune while everybody talks about what did he know. Not what did they know, but what did he know. And Mr. Gregg, George Bush's aide from the CIA and from Vietnam, and Chichi Quintero and Max Rodriguez, all this gang worked with George Bush and involved with cocaine traffic. But nobody on the Iran-Contra hearing is pointing a finger at George Bush or even mentioning his criminal activity in Iran or in South America or his connections. And he blew a lot of cases down in Miami by exposing to the media drug profiteers a day before they were to be arrested. So putting the American flag on the ship is very dangerous. There are a couple of other matters that also make it dangerous. One is Reagan's Armageddon complex. He has worked with Jerry Falwell at least 6 years with the Defense Department, planning and believing that the beginning of the end of the world will happen in the Middle East, and he sincerely believes this and belongs to a cult group, one or two, that does, so that putting ships in the Middle East is a biblical prophecy, and he can go down as a good Christian, if not a good president. And he also has had a fixation on Franklin Roosevelt. If you read his biography and articles about him, he always envisioned himself a commander-in-chief. I've mentioned this before. He always envisioned a third term, I guess even sitting in a wheelchair, and he would sail into a national security situation at the time of war, where if we criticized him or his friends, we would be aiding and abetting the enemy. So he could cancel 1988 elections. He is the president. He can do what he wants, and the network is there for him, and if he's crazy enough, he can do it, and if we don't recognize his symptoms, then we all have to be as crazy as he is. Now, Elliot Abrams, the Assistant Secretary of State, testified that Ollie North envisioned Alamo-style battles, fighting in Nicaragua, that he would sacrifice and have killed many of his Contra persons working with him, and in return it would influence public opinion and pull the United States into a war in Central America. The Christic Institute suit mentions the fact that the defendants in that suit, part of the secret team, wanted to kill the U.S. ambassador, Louis Tams, in Costa Rica, and blame Nicaragua for that as a chance to invade Nicaragua. Getting rid of Louis Tams, who as ambassador in Colombia, didn't like the cocaine traffic and moved to Costa Rica, where the Medellin cocaine traffickers were continuing their operation from Colombia through Costa Rica. And it would be convenient to unload this far right winger, get the sympathy of the people seeing him sacrifice and invade Nicaragua. So the Persian Gulf incident could be just a setup, exactly like the kind they were planning in Costa Rica or in Nicaragua, to sacrifice their own as a chance that then we can get a full-scale war going. Now, there was an editorial yesterday in the San Jose Mercury, no case against Robert Bork. And the editorial says that you can't restrict the appointment of Robert Bork, this is their opinion, on the Supreme Court on the grounds of ideology. And then they mention, and all of you know, as U.S. Solicitor General in 1973, Bork obeyed Richard Nixon's order to fire the special prosecutor at the time of Watergate, Archibald Cox, and Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus, the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General, resigned rather than carry out their orders. And the San Jose Mercury calls attention that if the Senate confirms Ronald Reagan's nomination of Bork to the Supreme Court, Bork could conceivably help undercut the authority of special prosecutors investigating various Reagan associates like Deaver and Meese and Knobziger and the Iran-Contra scandal. And the editorial says, go ahead and have Bork in anyway, even if he has the capacity to end all criminal investigations. Now, this country is so far gone that it defies logic to believe that an editorial writer from the San Jose Mercury believes, let Reagan have his quick appointment of Bork and cancel all investigations, because if he's the president, he doesn't have to be investigated. That's going pretty far along. And, of course, this last weekend there were articles, Reagan seeks quick confirmation of Bork. Why not? There was a syndicated column last week by Richard Reeves on Edwin Meese titled, Kick Out Meese First, Then Name Your Justice of the Supreme Court. And he said, if it sounds like I believe President Reagan's constitutionally proper Supreme Court nominee should be held hostage to politics, that is exactly what I believe. What are we paying this bum for, this Edwin Meese? Besides paying Meese his salary, we have to keep paying for special prosecutors for the crimes he committed that have been appointed, because he's under criminal questioning, either by himself and find either evidence or another rationale to say our attorney general didn't actually or knowingly violate the law. We have these prosecutors. And this is from the New York Times and San Jose Mercury and other papers. Get rid of Meese. He's barred from looking into attempted military intelligence coup called Irangate, because he was in on the planning of it all along. He's barred from doing anything about WedTech because he made money off the scammer, could be making. He's barred from investigating the Teamsters because of his close relationship to Mafia Jackie Presser, and it goes on and on. And then the San Francisco Examiner had an article just yesterday, which I call Photo Opportunity, that this administration loves. And there is an American flag being held up, and there's a U.S. envoy, and Abul Fatel El-Badar from Kuwait. And it says, House members, Kuwaitis, discussed the reflagging. And they made a point that the United States delegation, Representative Larry Hopkins, Republican of Kentucky, gave an American flag to Abul Fatah El-Badar, the chairman of Kuwait Petroleum Shipping, at a 4th of July ceremony, as if Kuwait and the Abdul believes the 4th of July is important. And it was at the United States Embassy in Kuwait. And the flag, which once flew over the United States Capitol, will be used on the first Kuwait oil tanker that will get U.S. Navy protection. And by all accounts, the CIA and other estimations, it could begin a shooting war. Nothing less than the flag from the United States Capitol. America doesn't have enough flags to give around, but the symbolism, it comes from Washington to Kuwait, and the message is, save my ass, get the shooting going so I can get off the hook. I'm sending you my own flag from the United States Capitol. That's the way I speak Reaganese, and I understand Ronald Reagan. Now, the news accounts this week, this weekend, were filled with stories about the martial law plan that Reagan had, and I'm going over that article at length with you, actually, for the remainder of the program and the material that's in there, because it is, in essence, the entire Reagan story, or an overview of it, of what's going on ever since he's been president, since or wanted to run in 1980. The article's titled North and the Secret Government, Martial Law Plan, Among the Work of Reagan Advisors. The date is July the 5th, 1987. It's written by Alfonso Chardy. It was published in the Miami Herald and San Jose Mercury, and sections were on the wire service. And this goes into Reagan and some documents that have existed for a long time but are coming to attention now because they connect to Ollie North. The article says that a martial law plan was drafted in 1984. It would impose martial law in the United States in the event of emergency. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North helped with the 1984 plans. Attorney General William French Smith was opposed to this. And as I read sections or I've outlined sections of the article, I had to intersperse my translation as we go along. Ollie North didn't create a 1984 plan. He updated it. The martial law plan was in effect at the time of the conventions, Republican conventions, in 1972. It was part of Squad 19 of Lewis Tapwood. It was a plan to even kill Richard Nixon and make Spiro Agnew president of the United States, with the CIA and the Greek military junta and the powers that be in Washington working this one out, the martial law plan. The only reason we didn't have it in 1972 was because the men were caught at the Watergate Hotel in June, and the convention wasn't until later in the summer, and the money that they had tied directly to the banks of people supplying guns and weapons for the demonstrations that would create the incidences that would cause martial law. Ronald Reagan put this together when he was governor of California from 1966 to 74. It was called the Garden Plot. He worked with Edwin Meese in Military Reserve. What he did as president was just update it, but he always had it on the plans. And the 1984 date is useful because of the Olympic Games, and I had done a lot of research on the fact that if the Russian athletes had come here, all the machinery was ready for a coup in 1984. The article continues, the Constitution would be suspended. Control of the government would go to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Appointed military commanders would run the state and local governments. Martial law would be declared in the event of nuclear war, violent or widespread internal dissent, or if there was a national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad. And of course, when Reagan came in, the very first National Security Council meeting involved Libya and it involved Iran. And he had on his mind going into Nicaragua and putting the Somozans back in power, taking the Marshall Islands, controlling the Philippines if the Marcoses got out of hand. going into Panama, Afghanistan, and any one of these operations, if there was opposition at home that Reagan saw during the Vietnam War under Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, then martial law could be called, and Ali North was creating the incidences with the TWA, the Kili Lora, the Pakistan hijacking, the Turkey bombing, the gunning in the synagogue. There were endless violences that I believe were agent provocateur out of Reagan, the Berlin disco. And then as he takes his military step, which we didn't mind when he took the poor little island of Grenada, we sat down like little tame animals and let him take it. If there had been opposition, he may have made his one of the moves then, but we sat back and said, it's all yours, and you can have the island, you're great. And that was planned by Oliver North and Admiral Poindexter and Robert McFarlane and the same team. The article says Colonel Oliver North's proposal and involvement was a proposal to radically alter American government by executive order in a time of crisis. And it is evidence he was involved in a wide range of secret foreign affairs, domestic affairs, far beyond the Iran-Contra affair. Life magazine has an interview with his wife, Betsy. Don't you understand what communism is? He's a patriot. He's a Christian. And everybody should be behind him. She doesn't balance, and neither does Life magazine, the next issue, the fact that he wanted to alter the American government and erase the Constitution. This is his version of Americanism to put us in a position like Korea or the Philippines under Marcos or under Pinochet in Chile. And the military dictatorships that we've put around the world are coming closer to our door. The North executive order that would have been signed didn't even need actually the president's signature. The way he wrote up the Constitution, it didn't need his signature. It was executive order 11490 that was put together for the president to sign, but the conditions were that we could have the coup by the colonels, the comparison of the Algerian colonels, that we came close to having this several times in this administration already, but he had the papers, or they had the papers. North was paid by the Marines. He worked at the National Security Council. He worked with Robert McFarlane from the Navy, an admiral from Annapolis. It was a military plan. It wasn't North's plan. And the emphasis is, what is North going to do? It was a plan from the National Security Council, which was set up to get rid of Congress anyway and take the decisions from Congress. He was simply a person working for them. The article says North was at the center of what amounted to a secret government within a government, according to Arthur Lyman, the chief counsel of the Senate committee. How could North be the center of anything that Reagan and Meese and the Defense Department planned 15 years ago? To make him the center is to make Hitler responsible for World War II, or Lee Harvey Oswald responsible for the whole Kennedy assassination. North understood the terms that he'd be the fall guy if it ever came down. He knew that, and he'll be a millionaire, and he'll be a hero. So all the committees are fingering North and letting everybody else off the hook. As I say, he has to be the Lee Oswald, James Earl Ray, Artie Bremer, Sirhan fall guy of this story. And to top it off, Albert Hakim testified that Ali North had a death wish. He would like to die for his country. He wanted nothing better than to die. So if they off him, or if he's suicidal, or they take him somewhere and he jumps out of the window like Bethesda, they could say that is what he always wanted. So he's willing to be the fall guy, but they're ready to kill him. And die for your country is part of the testimony that is fait accompli, it's been said. So you have no more surprises in the event that that would happen. Arthur Lyman, the chief counsel, said that before the hearings began, he expected to show that a foreign policy decision was made at the highest level to transfer U.S. support of the Nicaraguan Contras to the National Security Council, where North operated. Lyman, chief Senate counsel, said, "We favor examining how that decision was implemented to support the Contras from the NSC." Well, Lyman and Simon Rifkin, his law partner, our lawyer, represent Robert Vesco, one of the most important persons, the whole social fabric of America. Arthur Lyman knows how these decisions are made, and so does Simon Rifkin. They've been in the middle of this all along, but they want to divert it to what was Northman at mind, and they want to say, this is a quotation, that the story revealed the whole secret government within a government operated at the executive office building by a lieutenant colonel. So when he testifies this week and you hear him watch the camera zoom on the lieutenant colonel, and Lyman says he had they had their own army, air force, diplomatic agents, intelligence activities, and appropriations. Appropriations means funds. And Ollie North tapped into the Credit Suisse in Switzerland to Permandex money that overthrew the administration when Kennedy was president. I'll take a one-minute break and go back to the appropriations. Arthur Lyman knows better. He's a brilliant lawyer, and it'll be a good show. But it's not the whole show, and they're zooming in only on the president and Oliver North. Now, in the one-minute break I'm taking, I want to remind you that at the end of this hour, you get to call in and talk about what you're hearing. And last week, we talked about what you're feeling about all of this. I think it's important to know if people are responding emotionally or at a gut level about some of these convoluted things that are happening. And I'm wanting to hear from you and see if you're, of course, those of you who can will be watching the testimony all week.